Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Danielle, the U.S. cost of living dropped for the first time since the pandemic. If you go month to month, what kind of an impact is that going to have?
Yeah, so for the first time in a while, the reading came in under expectations, which is primarily led by a drop in energy costs. And also, we've seen some cooling, thankfully, in the shelter component, finally. Used car prices are down. And when used car prices go down, insurance prices finally follow. So those things have been real sticky during the, since the pandemic, as prices went up so much and insurance followed. And rents followed as prices of homes went up. But since that's now starting to come back down, the insurance component follows. So that's really helping. And it is, basically it was the third straight month that the inflation rate fell for the U.S. It's the lowest in 1 year. It was below market expectations, as I said. And that's a trend that, the core inflation rate declined as well, ex food and energy, which is all kind of going in the right way. So that's positive. But, the after effects are still evident throughout in terms of struggling homes, households, So an interesting little summary I was looking at. So in the 6 years that Jerome Powell has been the Fed chair in the United States, Jim, the CPI basket has increased 26% in that time frame. And you can compare that till, everyone talks about the inflation of the 1970s when Paul Volcker came in and, increased rates so much to try and finally kill the inflation impulse. The rate of CPI that went up 54% in his 8-year tenure. So even though the pace of that inflation is slowing, the weight of the increased costs are still in the system and weighing on the ability of households to spend. The other thing that happens here, and we're seeing that in all kinds of data where consumers have been pulling back for a long time now. The latest today was Pepsi announcing that its Frito-Lay North American sales volumes have come off about 4%, same for the drinks side. And they, company after company is reporting this consumer just not spending as much, or where they are spending, we're seeing them do it in really tenuous ways, like on buy now, pay later schemes, credit cards, any kind of debt that they can add to. They've been doing that now for so long that they've really run out of runway there. So it's kind of a desperation where you see them adding any kind of discretionary spend tends to be on credit. And that's all kind of part and parcel of this story of, slowing profit growth for companies, because as the companies are saying, they don't have pricing power in an environment where consumers are buying less volume of everything, right? So this is where it starts to really dawn on stock owners or stock buyers that they have paid so much for the expectation of escalating earnings. Like just year to date, the S&P earnings per share estimates have gone up about 2.6%, but the price of the S&P, which has been buoyed by a handful of shares, has gone up about six times that. So you've had this mania of overpaying for rosy earning expectations, all while companies are reporting, you know, slower sales across the board. And now with the CPI coming off, you know, there's a revelation that, okay, so, you know, today it was interesting. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, who's quite an acclaimed economist, was saying today, and she's been hawkish and saying she wasn't prepared to okay any rate cuts. Today she said that the data is lining up now that she sees they should probably move to cut in the not too distant future. And that's a function of, you know, a whole bunch of things that have been kind of running off red flags for the U.S. economy, but the U.S. ISM manufacturing services and manufacturing data in June has been falling, and that typically has only ever happened in the past in recessions. It's contracted manufacturing, even with all the fiscal spending that's been going on in the U.S., the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the massive deficits they've been running to stimulate their economy. You've seen the U.S. manufacturing data contract in 19 of the past 20 months. That's the longest a streak since the great financial crisis. And when both manufacturing and services are contracting, you've always been in recessions historically. So there's just kind of, you know, unemployment data. 80% of people looking for jobs have not been able to find them. The quits rate is way down. People are not looking to change jobs. They're trying to stay where they are. And part of that is, you know, if there's less inflationary pressure, they're sort of trying to sit tight and just collect the incomes that they're getting. But there's still a lot of layoffs spreading. And as I said, unemployment continuing claims have continued to increase month over month because people just are not able to replace jobs. So when you've got this downturn in employment, unemployment is a lagging indicator. I've mentioned that many times. It takes a long time for that factor to really start to appear evident in the data. But we definitely have seen, you know, the unemployment rate in Canada has increased significantly off the bottom to 6.2 in the latest data. And the same in the U.S. where it's now up to 4.1. And these kind of increases have typically commensurate with the start of past recessions. So you've got the manufacturing, you got services and manufacturing coming off, you've got unemployment rising, job creation stumbling, and the retail sales numbers are really weak. So all these things really suggest that, as you know, we've been saying for a long time now, several months, that the U.S. could already be in recession. It's looking like it's possible that that will be backdated in retrospect by the Niebuhr Committee to have commenced potentially even in the last, you know, quarter of last year of 2023, but evident in the data in 2024. And all that matters because the Fed has been, you know, really tight. Real interest rates have been held at very high levels in most of the developed world, including in Canada, as you know. And that has had this really lagged impact on things like the housing market, and a lot of people, and unemployment, and a lot of people have sort of written off the potential for a downturn or a recession, saying, you know, it hasn't come yet, so it's not going to come at all. But Canada's already starting to see job losses. In June, we had job losses. And as I say, once the consumer is cash-strapped, indebted, and, you know, has as little liquid savings as they do in North America right now, then it tends to be harbinger of things getting much worse and strife spreading to the real estate market, which is the other big shoe to drop here.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's happening with real estate? Are prices dropping?
Yes, so the amount of listings continues to soar, the amount of sales continues to fall. So the inventory is rising, you know, it's remarkably so in many areas, certainly in major cities in America and certainly in Toronto and Ontario, which was the benefactor of the greatest increases during the pandemic mania when everyone was borrowing their brains out and trying to buy whatever they could. We're certainly seeing a much slower uptake of any purchases. Mortgage applications are at, you know, multi-year lows. People just can't qualify for financing. And as I say, as unemployment rises or income falls, you know, whether it's a lot of part-time jobs replacing full-time jobs, that kind of thing, people just don't have the means to qualify for more debt to purchase properties at current prices. So you're seeing that weakening trend go on for go across most markets now. And really, again, this stuff is always blindsides people that aren't aware of the lags, because it can take, you know, many months for the rate hiking cycle to kick in. And usually, historically, a downturn in real estate takes, you know, 5 or 6 years for prices to bottom from the peak, which is hard for people to follow a plot that long, Jim, because they sort of go, oh, you know, rates were hiked and they didn't think that the market fell apart in their neighborhood or in the data they were watching, but it's really starting to show up now. And things like condos, which were so insanely overbought during the pandemic and overpriced, you know, we're seeing the drops in prices of 25% easily in many properties in the GTA area near where I live. So just tracking the actual, you know, listing, days on the market, amount of reductions in price, and then ultimately if you do get a sale relative to what people paid at the peaks during the 2021-2022, we're seeing a lot of losses, and it's pretty brutal for people.
I think here in the Vancouver area, if you're in a very desirable area, prices are the same or a bit higher. But in areas that aren't so popular, I think we've seen some significant drops as well.
Sure. And then, you know, the issue with the really expensive properties, the multi-million dollar, you know, 4 million and up sort of category, is that they're always pretty illiquid. Like, there's not a lot of people that can buy those properties, and even in a good time or when, you know, the economy is strong. So they are kind of an outlier, but they're not liquid. So this is the thing. When people, you know, start to get a cash crunch, this is what we're certainly seeing in the commercial real estate market, all across the world, really, but certainly in North America, where, you know, again, there was a ton of so-called investor capital just flooding into that space during when interest rates were at all-time lows and everyone was trying to buy up everything. And now we've got vacancy rates, you know, above 20% in major cities. And a lot of these, the people that are investor groups that purchased these properties are now just walking away from them, leaving them with the lender. Or when they are being sold, they're being sold for like shocking discounts, more than 50% discounts from where they were purchased, just because they want to get the carrying costs off their books, because it's cash flow negative. And so, you know, that's that crunch that hits when people need cash, you know, they try and take it from anywhere they can get it. And that's when some of the high-end properties will be, you know, put on the market thinking that or hoping that someone will give them liquidity that they need for other businesses or other, you know, deficits they may have in their spending and budget. But in fact, they typically don't sell quickly those properties. And so that's where the rubber meets the road. When they sit and you get an intensifying need for cash, you'll ultimately see big price cuts across the board, including in those very expensive properties.
I think in LA, the very expensive properties move because of the divorce rate there amongst all the elite.
Oh, I haven't seen any data to suggest the divorce rate's higher there than anywhere else, but it's certainly 50% plus in most places.
Right, and except there, when you have people worth hundreds of millions, their properties are usually worth a lot too when they split up. I'm just thinking about J-Lo and Ben buying that huge estate, and then they're not living together anymore. And that might be a major factor, but that's a particular market. That's not typical.
You know, I recently visited Casa Loma in Toronto with my family just last week. And for anyone that's in the area or hasn't been there, it's a fantastic place to visit. And, you know, there's a story of a very successful business magnate in Canada in the late 1800s, early 1900s, who had his fingers in so many different businesses, rolling out electricity, you know, hydropower, all kinds of things, and started building this mansion in the early 1900s. And at the time, you know, was spending, you know, more than most people, he spent more on his stables or his horse shed than most people spent on mansions in Toronto in those days. So anyway, the building went on for 10 years, and by the time it finished, there was a guy who had exotic art collections and, you know, just one of those people that seemed to be so wealthy that they could afford anyone, you know, anything. And indeed, in the end, they ended up having to sell off the home, auction off the contents for pennies on the dollar. And he ended up basically broke and living with his chauffeur. And so it just goes to show you that even people that have, you know, a lot of diverse income streams and have, evidently good business acumen, was on the board of, you know, dozens and dozens of big companies, and still, because he overspent, you know, he was spending $100,000 a year just to maintain his home at that point, which was, as I say, in the early 1900s, just an astronomical sum of money. So consumption is very overrated, and people who spend too much of it, of their cash flow, often end up in trouble, regardless of what their, you know, income level is. It's a question of, does the income level continue long enough to bail them out?
A good judge of the real economy, perhaps, are here where I live in New Westminster. Pubs and restaurants that have existed for 40, 50 years have all gone out of business.
Yeah, well, that was part and parcel of the low-rate environment, too, when people could eat out, you know, more than they would have otherwise been able to because they were using credit to do so, and it became habitual, and people stopped cooking, and, you know, we saw that in all kinds of trends that you can track. But yeah, the build out in the restaurant space was too much to be sustainable, and now that people are pulling in, you're seeing that trend across businesses all over the country, and even the ones that are keeping their doors open, the data at the moment is really rough in terms of, you know, 50% of them say they're losing money trying to stay open, and we've seen it in the bankruptcy data, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, unfortunately, we had, you know, easy credit was like a fertilizer that grew consumption across everything, and now a higher interest rates and high debt levels are the opposite, which is really stamping out activity in all kinds of sectors.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, what's happening in the bond market?
So the bond market has been rallying year to date. The Treasury market has been rallying in recognition of this rising unemployment rate, and it's been basically looking at central bank forecasts and saying that they thought central banks were being too optimistic in terms of the amount of economic activity that would be possible to continue with rates at the current levels. And certainly in the last several months, the bond market has been rallying, prices increasing, which brings their yields down, which impacts things like mortgage rates and credit available through the economy. So that is just a reflection of this vote, basically, that the economy is weaker than the central banks and many of the consensus opinions have been suggesting that it is. And, you know, so things like the stock market, as I mentioned, have rallied so much more than the earnings forecast because they've had this uber optimistic outlook. The market vein, for example, bullish sentiment is at 71% today, which was the same as it was in May of 2007 and November of 2021, when the mania was, you know, writ large. Now, the difference, of course, in 2021 versus now is that interest rates have gone up, you know, several percent in the meantime, and people are stumbling and the economy's weaker and unemployment is on the rise, as I said. And we know that once unemployment starts to rise, as it has been now for the past many months, that it typically continues through all the way as the economy contracts, and even as the economy begins to recover on the other side, people keep losing their jobs because businesses are going under and the excess is wrung out of the economy. So basically, treasuries are rallying, and today we're seeing that a nice pop in their prices. even as the large tech names have been selling off. So this is an interesting thing. You know, I've been writing about this extreme concentration in the handful of the five largest tech companies, for example, five largest U.S. tech companies being this ridiculous 29% concentration of the S&P 500 index, and how that was, you know, a red flag of unsustainability. And we've seen, you know, it's the highest concentration, those five most expensive companies, the most concentrated that since 1965, and more extreme even than in the 2000 tech top. And why that matters is because if people understand anything about secular cycles, these are, you know, periods of time in history where we get to, you know, multi-year highs in valuations in terms of asset prices or multi-year lows. Multi-year highs typically portend losses over the coming several months or several years even, and the opposite is true when you get valuations crushed to all-time lows. So right now, 1965 was a just about as concentrated as the S&P is today, and it was followed by a secular bear market that went from 1966 to 82. During that period, stocks lost value. They went through four down cycles of 25 to 45% four times, and it took 16 years for them to grow back their losses. And during that time, the price-to-earnings multiple on the S&P, for example, went from 21 times earnings, about where it is today. In 1966, it was similar, to 8 times by 1982, which just suggests, again, this wringing out process of excess valuation and excess bullish sentiment and overpaying for everything. There's this sobering period of very challenging conditions that go the opposite way. And that's what we're starting to see now, and I think it could continue for a significant period. And that's a problem because, as I said, everyone is the most exposed to equities today. Both professional managers and households have record exposure to the stock market. And those who think they're indexing the S&P 500 and therefore have a diversified basket of holdings would be maybe shocked to learn that, in fact, they're not very diversified because these, you know, 5 to 10 companies that have really driven all the gains in the last few years are the ones that are most vulnerable in this environment. Indeed, today, when you see this revelation that there could be rate hikes as early as even the end of July, the July 31st meeting of the Fed, or certainly by September, you know, the unexperienced or unenlightened observers may think, oh great, they're going to cut rates, that'll you know, stop the bleeding, so to speak, and save everything. But actually, that's when the stock market begins to sell off the worst, because they are always reacting to the bad data in terms of the economy and in terms of unemployment. And so once they start cutting, they tend to cut for several meetings in a row, and during that time the stock market continues to fall and unemployment continues to rise, and the economy tends to do badly. So that's when treasury bonds typically rise in price, cash is king, and equities tend to tumble. So that's going to be a pretty dangerous period for people who are not aware of that cycle, who are now 24 years older than they were in 2000, the last time that the tech bubble was as garish as it has been today. And they have a lot less time to make back losses. So these are the people that hold the bulk of the assets in the country, you know, the baby boomers, et cetera. They don't have a very high risk tolerance, even though they may think that they do, because they've been lulled into a sense of complacency by the recent experience, you know, of the short, sharp downturn in 2020 that was quickly reviled with all this, reversed with all the free money that was thrown at the economy and the central banks into the stock market. But those conditions are not evident at any time soon here, and that means that we could get a sustained bear market, which where everyone is, you know, losing money and looking to raise cash. And I think that that is something people should be on the lookout for.
Danielle, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
No, that's it. There's a lot going on, and I think that there's going to be an awful lot of opportunity coming out of this on the other side, like historic opportunity, but that means for cash. And typically, very few people have cash to put to work because they go into these things fully invested and holding the wrong assets, and I'm afraid that's where most people are today.
Danielle, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.